word of the Lord.
After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over a place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. When they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "and take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I shall call my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in the dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene."
One of the reasons why I thought this text was especially relevant this morning is because this is the candle of peace. But what is the first thing that happens when it is announced that Jesus is to be born? There's violence. And this king, Herod, seeks to have all of these children put to death and slain. So it's sort of an interesting thing. It makes you wonder about the question, why do we call Jesus the Prince of Peace? Where does that come from? Why do we make this claim? Especially in a world today where I think peace is so elusive, is it not? We live in a very divided time, a time where around every corner of things there is tension and strife of one sort or another. And many of us, I think, want to cover it up, or many of us want to maybe not talk about it or believe that it's not there. And we do this, all of us, don't we? Even in our own family lives. I remember growing up being at my own house, or even seeing sometimes friends, there would be something going on, a quarrel in the home, if you will. Maybe mom or dad's not too happy with one of the children, and there's a dispute, and there's a little bit of a tension going on. And then the phone rings. You ever seen someone change their attitude immediately? And then it goes from "Stop that nonsense!" to "Yes, hello." Sort of a problem going on at home. And we this too when we're being social in town, right? This is probably more common down where I'm from, where, you know, someone asks, how you doing today, you know?
I'm good.
I mean, you could be going through, you just got walked out of a car accident, you're having a coma. And most of the time we're going to tell people, I'm pretty good, you know? That's kind of the natural gut reaction. So many of us, I think, even in the details of our lives, want to cover up the fact that that there's trouble and that there's difficulty that's very present. And I don't think it's any news to any of you, maybe, that the world we live in the public realm, is extremely divided and tense today. If you turn on the news, you see the racial tensions with all that's going on in the Ferguson trials and the events that have followed that. Here at home, there's a lot of social tensions, right? You see, you bring up certain topics. What are some of these classic, famous topics that make everyone really nervous? You can just mention them and hair stands up on your neck. And talk about abortion or homosexuality or assisted suicide and these sorts of topics. It gets us all tense because the atmosphere in America is very tense around those subjects. We live in a time of great political tension. And I don't think it's news to anyone that there's massive, widespread distrust of our government. I think that's pretty standard. More and more people today are identifying as independent than ever before. Actually, a recent poll put on by Gallup earlier this year shows that 42% of people that were polled, this was several thousand folks from all over the country that were polled about their political allegiances, identify themselves as independent. So almost half of everyone polled now says that they are independent. Gallup themselves say this about that fact. The rise in political independence is likely an outgrowth of Americans' record or near record negative views of the two major U.S. parties of Congress and their general level of distrust of government more generally. So, I think we're living, clearly the statistics are showing, in a time of political turmoil as well. Economic uncertainty. I mean, I think very few of us in here would say that there is extreme and great security and peace about either our own personal finances, maybe, or where our country is headed. Jobs are hard to find. We just recently, maybe y'all saw on the news, crossed the $18 trillion deficit, I think it was. We're now in the hole, $18 trillion, which is hard to even fathom. And many people are sort of saying that there's an economic fallout that is right around the corner. Our money's going to collapse. The Federal Reserve is printing it into oblivion. You know, you better go get you some silver and gold because our dollar is going to be nothing. So you're hearing these sorts of things even on an economic level. What about in our schools, our public schools? We see lots of turmoil there as well. I actually just at the open house last night, a gentleman came over who's gotten to be a pretty good friend of mine. He lives in the Rutland area, or used to now. He's just moved up to Burlington. And he was telling me that he's trying to start up a Ratio Christi chapter, which I've shared some of that with you folks in here, which is the Reason of Christ. It's a campus ministry. And he's trying to get one started on the campus of UVM. And he was telling me that one of his key contact students there at the school has a class where just recently the professor went into probably a good 20-minute spiel about how, you know, creationism is false and the God of the Bible is, you know, anyone who believes that sort of stuff is ridiculous, and explicit sort of anti-Christian teaching that's happening on the university campus. And that's just one example. This is very, very, very common now. We're seeing that people who take certain positions, and even in science, there was a documentary put out that had some humor to it, but nonetheless, I think speaks to some truth in our culture by a man named Ben Stein, called Expelled, probably some 10 years ago, I think it was. And, you know, he basically interviewed all these people who believe in what's called intelligent design, people who embrace the idea that there is good evidence in creation that are in the world, that there is a designer behind it, that there is a God who sort of fashioned things in a certain way and it works together in a certain way. But if you believe that, in some places, you can lose your job very, very quickly, or you can fail to get a promotion. And he demonstrated this in this documentary. And even in our schools, like even just down the road here at South Royalton School, not long ago, there was a bomb threat. And we're seeing this more and more, are we not? Shootings in school, tension, division in the classroom, And that's, of course, apart from all the wars and the threats of war that are going on around the globe. You think of Iran and the idea of maybe them getting nuclear weapons, or Russia and how they were the aggressor, or they intervened, as they maybe are calling it, in Ukraine. Drone strikes in the Middle East, the bloodshed going on in Africa between Muslims and Christians, and terrorist attacks like terrorist attacks like 9/11, or what's going on with ISIS and all of this. So I think I've made my case that there is a lot of turmoil in the world. There's little peace. And the sum total of all of this, I think, for people is that they feel, you know, that life is a bit crazy. But we still kind of have that tendency, I think, to cover it up and act like things are okay, try and keep going about our business. Advent, too. And sadly, I think most of you would agree with me that Advent is a time where very few of us really experience the peace and the joy of the season. You've got a shopping list, you've got parties to get to, you know, up here in Vermont, you've got weather issues that you're really trying to navigate around that complicate things a little bit, even though things, for the most part, continue on as planned here. Advent, sadly, is not very much a time of peace for many of us, is it? We hustle around, we stress, maybe we grow a little disillusioned, get fatigued even, and we sort of just wish that it would be over. We wait and long for the new year, do we not? So sadly, even Advent doesn't bring the commercialization and all of that, I think, takes away from any feeling or illusion of peace, maybe, that we want to present sometimes. Well, some would go as far as to say that all of those things I just mentioned in the world, the political problems, the social problems, maybe even economic problems, the wars, the tension in our culture on the school campuses, and all of that, some people would go as far as to say that religion is not part of the solution. In fact, it's a part of the problem. Some would say that while we sit here and we call Jesus the Prince of Peace and we light the candle of peace, others would say, you know what, that God and that prophet, he's a sower of hate, of bigotry, of violence, and of ignorance. So religion for many people is not a peaceful thing. So you might be wondering, okay, Pastor, we're all here in church this morning. We probably don't believe that. So why are you going through all of this detail with us about what people might think in our culture at large? Well, because your neighbors think this. There are a lot of folks right here in Vermont that really do have a sense of conservative, Bible-believing, Bible-based religion is divisive, and it's not a peacemaking, peaceful concept. If you were to meander over here to VLS, I think, and interact with some of the faculty and some of the students, you would get a sense of all of that. You would get a sense of how people have come out of or experienced hatred or bigotry in one way or the other, as they would describe it, from religious people, Christians in particular. And y'all will probably know this, being that y'all lived here for a long time. And have probably experienced it maybe even more than me. But your neighbors have these thoughts about religion. Many of them are Christianity. It's not... So I'm just trying to set it up as we talk about Prince of Peace and what that means and how it's perceived by our culture. But I want to say too this, that most people who think of Christianity as a divisive, non-peaceful sort of thing, do you think that they may be immediately associated with the wars or with, you know, all of the tensions that we have, 9/11 and all that? Most likely your average person would say no. They wouldn't necessarily blame Christians or blame religion necessarily on or for all those things that we just mentioned. But they would say that on a level of society, it's those fanatics, it's those fundamentalists, or those radicals that are to blame for a lot of the tensions that we have. So maybe it's not all Christians, maybe it's not, you know, you and me, maybe it is some of us, but it's more of those radical guys, you know, the Westboro Baptist types that are saying, thank God for dead soldiers. That sort of, you know, gays are going to hell, that kind of stuff. The ones that are speaking against the Democratic Party and premarital sex and pop culture and public schools and movies and Hollywood. Those are the people that are causing all of the division. So many people would think, I think, that they would associate that sort of stuff with Christianity, right? They would make those connections and everything. That's really what we're talking about here. Not maybe the Crusades or these wars or whatever that's going on, but sort of that general sense of intolerance. Christians are very, very intolerant. They're self-righteous, and it's unattractive and even repulsive to many. So why are we here this morning if that's sort of the perception? I mean, is it true, I guess, on one hand would be one question, but why are we... What is this Prince of Peace thing? How does it factor into that? We're in a culture that precedes us, or at least maybe a certain branch of Christianity, as very fanatical, intolerant, self-righteous. What is this Prince of Peace thing all about? Well, I remember when I first came to Jesus, I was labeled that by a lot of people. I remember when I would come home and talk to my family and my friends, it wasn't always welcomed as very positive. Suddenly, because I'd grown up in a Christian home, and I was going to church and I was doing those sorts of things, but suddenly I had opinions. And suddenly, I went off to college and I got to interact with some of these folks, and I was beginning to talk about it in my everyday life, beginning to ask and inquire and see where people were in their relationship with God, and even asking them questions that were a little uncomfortable. And that's sort of when the flags went up. It was like, you know, Josh, I don't know that this is helpful. Like, you're taking this too serious. That's the reaction I got from a lot of folks. And we do have a sort of feeling in our culture, don't we, that Christianity's okay, religion's okay, as long as it remains moderate. You know, don't get too serious with that. Don't get too religious. Don't believe Jesus too much. Just a little bit. You know, you want to stay somewhere in this moderate range, this nominal to quasi-serious range, maybe. Once you start talking about it in your everyday life, now it's fanatical or whatever. But in a way, I think all of this feeling that a lot of folks in our culture have about the kind of fanaticism that I'm trying to mention this morning, I think is right. I think in a way that there is something to this, this sort of repulsive feeling that we have towards the folks that maybe, and I'm not condemning them, but toward that sort of feeling that we have when we see the Christians out picketing with the signs and going to the homosexual rallies and shouting at them, and you see that sort of back and forth because it goes both ways. But in part, right, that sort of reaction, I think, is good. It's not all good, this fundamentalist, radical kind of Christianity that we see. And I think a part of the reaction is good because we've got it wrong. This is what I want to say, that in fact, the problem with fanaticism, or what I'm calling as fanaticism, or the problem with maybe a lot of Christians that do some of the things I'm talking about, is that they're not, now hear me on this, fanatical enough. So I don't care, Pastor Josh, you just said that the problem is that they were taking it too seriously, right? No, that's not what I said. That's what the culture thinks, right? That's what people around us say, oh, you're getting too serious. That's what I heard from family and from friends early on when I became a believer, is, this is getting out of hand here. You're being a little too serious about this stuff. But what I want to say to you this morning is that I early on, probably still some today, and a lot of these fanatics, in fact, aren't fanatical enough. I think that's really what the problem is. What do I mean by that? How so? Well, Tim Keller makes this point in one of his books, The Reason for God. He says this: the people who are fanatics then are not so because they are too committed to the gospel, but because they are not committed to it enough. Many Christians are fanatically zealous, this is Keller, and courageous, but they are not fanatically humble, sensitive, loving, empathetic, forgiving, or understanding as Christ was. Because they think of Christianity as a self-improvement kind of moral system or program They emulate the Jesus of the whips in the temple, but not the Jesus who said, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." So what strikes us as overly fanatical is actually a failure to be fully committed to Christ and his gospel. Keller points out, this is really, really interesting, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., all of y'all be very familiar with him, I'm sure, big civil rights guy, he points out the fact that he was probably the greatest, at least in our history here in America, the greatest proponent and champion of justice that we've seen in our lifetime through in our era, the greatest proponent of justice. And what did he do? What was his method? He didn't say, "Hey, you know, you white Christians out there, you white folks need to stop taking your religion so seriously." He didn't say that because they were being fanatical and, you know, bigoted and racist and all that. He said, "No, in fact, you need to take it more seriously." So the solution is not less of the gospel or less of Christianity, but a deeper and truer Christianity. We don't need less of Jesus and less of the gospel message. We need a more accurate one, and we need more of it. This is what Martin Luther King advocated. So what I'm trying to say here is that I think our temptation when people react to the fact that religion or Jesus, and we bring these things up, it's very divisive, and it's very, you know, it comes across as they're, you know, fanatical, or you're being radical, or you're being divisive, and warmongering, and all of this. The reason that a lot of people have that impression is because we actually are hateful and bigoted and unloving. We are those things, but the problem is not Christianity or Jesus. The problem is that we're actually not hearing Jesus. We're not embracing the real Jesus, the real message of the cross, the real message of Christianity. And that's where a lot of the problems, I think, come from, with how we're perceived in our culture. So, the meaning of the Prince of Peace thing here, that's why this is all sort of hitting me like a wave, because I was just thinking about this. I was like, you know, we're here to celebrate Jesus, we're here to celebrate the fact that he had peace on earth, he declared that, but there's no peace, there's not peace anywhere. So what do we make of this? What do we do with this as Christians when our neighbor says to us, "Yeah, but you Christians are all about some war. Look at your politicians who claim to be Christians are yet bombing people and droning them and doing this and that and the other thing." Walking through a field one day, and next thing you know, your aunt and your uncle are in 100 pieces, and you're a Christian, and you're claiming to follow Jesus. These are your representatives. These are, you know, what about those folks out there causing all the strife and bitterness and whatever that we see throughout culture? You're going to hear this if you're talking to people about the Lord and about Jesus and what it means to follow him. And we're in the middle of the Advent season. This is the big thing about Advent. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. How do we make sense of this? What is this peace that Jesus brings? Why do we call him the Prince of Peace? So I'm trying to get across everything I've been wrestling with, and sorry if it's a bit fuzzy. I'm laboring to really try to make it clear where I'm going with all of this. But what I want to do is give you two negative statements. So two statements about why Jesus is not the Prince of Peace. So two reasons why we would not say he's the Prince of Peace. So just say, what's that mean to you? Don't say these things. Don't say these first two things. And then I'm going to say two reasons why he is the Prince of Peace. Two reasons, two positive reasons why, yes, we can respond and say, okay, here's the two reasons that we, or two of the reasons, there's many of them, why we would describe Jesus as the Prince of Peace. So here's the first one. First of all, Jesus is not our Prince of Peace because of any promise to give us earthly peace. Jesus never promised that. He didn't promise us health. He didn't promise us wealth. He didn't promise us earthly peace. So that's not it. So when someone says, "Why do you follow this? Jesus is Prince of Peace. Look at all your people causing all this division and strife." Well, Jesus never said that we wouldn't, or that he would bring peace. The kind of peace maybe that we're so quick to think. John 14 says this. There's a verse that Jesus says, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give to you, though, as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." So Jesus acknowledges himself that there is a peace that he does give, but it's not as the world gives. It's not the kind of peace maybe that we're so quick to think. It's a political peace, or maybe a treaty, or some kind of absence of war, maybe, is what we would think. So Jesus does not give us peace in terms of earthly resources. It goes deeper than that. It's not a financial peace, necessarily. It's not a political peace. It's not an earthly kind of thing. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Right from the very beginning, if you go back to Genesis, what you're going to find if you look through the Bible, this is what you're going to see when you look at the Bible. If you go through and you read the whole story of the Bible, here's the essence of what you're going to find. You're going to find a story of two families. One is God's family and one is not. And these families, there's strife between these two families all the time, all throughout the Bible, as you're going to see. And from the very, very beginning, you have Cain and Abel. What happens? Murder, right? The one who was sort of outside of God's will, the one who wasn't really living for God, murdered the other one. Right from the beginning, back in Genesis. And here in Matthew 2, in our text, part of the reason why I chose it this morning was to illustrate this point. What happens right when Jesus comes into the world? What's the very first thing? Strife, right? Here's a guy who's coming along and wants to take my throne, not having it. And he murders him. At almost every turn in Jesus' ministry, his influence, his message, and his followers were challenged. Not only was Jesus killed, but all the original disciples were killed but one. It says something, doesn't it? That there's whatever it was that Jesus came to do, whatever his peace is, it clearly wasn't to just be friends with everybody. Though we can pursue that, and it's good to say so to do that. Intentionally make enemies or upset people, of course. We're to sacrifice and to love, which I'm going to get to in just a moment. But the point is that whatever this peace is, it wasn't just everything's going to be kosher and cool all the time and we're going to be friends with everybody. There is no promise of earthly peace. If you find it, let me know. I don't see it in the Bible. So right at the outset, we should set that aside. Second of all, so don't say that. Someone says, hey, why is Jesus your Prince of Peace? What's that mean? Don't say because he gives us earthly peace. No, don't say that. And don't say this because Jesus validates everything we do either. Don't say, because there is a way, right? So you're arguing at home with a brother or sister or maybe your spouse or a friend or something. You're getting in an argument. One way to end it, right, is to just say, yeah, you're right. You could end it that way, couldn't you? Yankees are the best. No, Red Sox are the best. And you're just going to murder each other over this issue. You say, oh, yeah, you're right. Yankees are the best. You could end it, right? I mean, that would end it in a way. It would just agree. So that would be one way of ending it. Maybe Jesus could bring us a peace where he would just say, you know what, everything you're doing is great. I agree with everything that's going on in your life. I support absolutely everything that you're doing. That might bring some kind of a peace out of it, right? I mean, or at least it would appear. But that's not the way Jesus does it. And it's in part because those of you who have children will know this, that we don't always do things that promote peace. Do we? So if Jesus comes in, pats on the back, says, that's great, man, that's go do this, go do that. And it leads to destruction. He's actually not promoting peace in our lives, is he? He's promoting destruction. Keep pounding those hamburgers every day in your life. That'll be good. No, that's not the kind of peace that Jesus promotes. He comes in and he says, you know what, you need to live in a certain way that's going to promote peace in your life. There's a certain way to live that will not only be best for you, but for the others around you. So he doesn't create peace by just validating everything we do. So that's not peace either. So don't say the very often phrase that we hear in our culture, because Jesus accepts me exactly how I am. Well, he does at first, but he also accepts you in order to change you. It's not just about, I am who I am and I'm going to always be that way. No. Jesus loves us all where we are. There's no doubt about that. But he has a goal and a purpose and plan for our life to bring about a real and deep peace. And that requires change for all of us across the board. So Jesus doesn't create peace by just patting us on the back. That's not the way he does it or validating everything. And it's really interesting, too, and I wanted to make this note because I think it's such a serious issue that we're dealing with in our culture right now. It's the language of tolerance. You have this language of tolerance that goes around and we see in our culture, and it's sort of an attempt, I think, to eliminate, at least in Christian circles, because you do hear this in a lot of Christian circles as well, They'll say something like this. The main thing about Jesus' message was love and acceptance. That's the main thing about what Jesus had to say. If he was a lover of all peoples, he accepted all peoples. Jesus was sort of, they make him out to sort of be this hippie type who, you know, didn't have any beef with anyone or anything. Just kind of went around, you know, long hair, loving on everybody, dreadlocks, whatever. And that's sort of the way we picture Jesus, you know. It's this guy who's just real friendly, never made an issue with anyone. But in a way, those folks, right, are doing the same thing that the other fanatics are doing. So maybe the other fanatics are constantly focused on hell. You're going to hell! They say that everywhere they go. They're emphasizing that. Well, on the other side, you've got people saying, no, Jesus loves you. Act like God. Keep doing what you're doing. It's all right. God will accept you and be right where you are. You've got the two extremes, right? They're just doing the same thing. They're fanatical about different points. Right? What about all of it? What about if we were fanatical about all of it? Let's be fanatical about the love and fanatical about God's desire to change us and make us right and bring us into a place of holiness and beauty before God in the way we live. So this language of tolerance, I wanted to quickly talk about how interesting it is that as we try and, because the love and acceptance thing, I think that we hear in a lot of Christian circles and in politics as well, we hear a lot of this. A lot of that, actually, why is it that it results in less freedom and more intolerance? Right? So we live, I think all of us would agree, we live in a very politically correct society, right? If you go out there, I mean, I can say something right now that would totally just offend everyone or create a lot of awkwardness or whatever. I mean, it'd be really easy because of the culture we live in. We live in a very politically correct culture, and you got to be careful about what you say and what you do and where you go and all of that, those sorts of things. But wouldn't you think that if, as tolerance increased, the natural thought would be, wow, I can say whatever I want. Isn't that the natural thought? You're going to tolerate me no matter what I do. I mean, you know, I can just go crazy out there and start throwing stuff and go crazy. And y'all just go, oh, this is great. Right? Wouldn't you think? I mean, really, like, that's the natural direction. Tolerance would lead to more freedom, more, like, expressiveness. I can do whatever I want to do because y'all are going to love me and tolerate and accept me as I am. But we're not seeing that, are we? What are we seeing? In fact, we're seeing less freedom of speech, less freedom of religion. We're seeing a squelching of religion on the campuses and on other places. This natural byproduct of tolerance is actually a great deal of intolerance. And why is that? Why is that? Well, there's a number of reasons, I think, why that is, because it's not really about tolerance. It's about you making me comfortable, right? It's about, I only want to hear stuff that makes me comfortable. And we're putting that on God. We're saying, oh, God, He has to validate everything I do, right? God needs to make me comfortable. That's what this is about. God's a, He's an extra sort of stool in my life or a crutch or whatever that kind of holds me up. When I'm feeling bad, I know that God accepts me and loves me exactly as I am. And that's a half-truth. And so it is, but God also wants to change, as I said just a second ago, change us. So anyways, it's an interesting thing, but I wanted to bring that up because it's an illusion to think that this just loving and accepting sort of mentality will produce freedom and good things and tolerance and all of that and peace. And in fact, will not bring about peace. We're more divided in this country than we've been since the Civil War. I've heard this from numerous people that I listen to online, articles that I've read. We're in a divided place. But we're in the era of tolerance. Why is that? It's because validation and blanket acceptance can't produce peace. It can't do it. Because if your lifestyle is destructive, it doesn't matter how much I love you, it's still going to be destructive. At some point, change has to happen. So don't tell folks when we say, why is Jesus your Prince of Peace? Well, because everything I do is okay with Jesus. No, that's not the way to do it. So you got those two points? We don't say because it gives us earthly peace. And we don't say because Jesus will validate or accept everything that I do. No, that's not it either. Okay, so why is Jesus our Prince of Peace? Okay, Pastor, give us two reasons why He is our Prince of Peace. I'm trying to give you some ammunition here and ways to think through all of this because it really was heavy on me as I was thinking about it. How can we say this is a season of peace? I mean, look at the chaos and the turmoil that comes up in this Advent season and all of that. Well, here's two reasons why we can say positively Jesus is our Prince of Peace. And the first one is out on our sign. If y'all saw it when you came in this morning, I hope you did. that you can have peace with God through Jesus. You may not have earthly peace, you may not have worldly comforts all the time, but you will have peace with God through Jesus. He establishes peace with God. So the peace that Jesus brings is first and foremost a spiritual peace. It's a peace that came through Jesus giving up power and rights, not asserting them. This is the power of the Christian message, that justice and peace don't come from me telling you what to do, asserting my authority, but me giving my life for you. That's how it comes, that actually through giving up of power, we have justice, we have peace. Our greatest enemy in this life is not the government, or the Muslims, or an economic collapse, or the Democrats, or the Republicans, or our next door neighbor. The greatest evil in our life are the things that we do that keep us from God. The things that we do that separate us from our Maker. Romans 5:1 says this, "Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." Jesus put an end to all that separated us from God. When we put our trust in Jesus, we have peace with God. When you stand in a courtroom, accused by the law, the judge can, if he's a righteous judge, and will render a verdict based upon how you stand before the law. If you've broken the law, you're guilty. And you should be convicted of that guilt, and you should be sentenced. If you're guilty of transgressing or breaking the law, which all of us have broken God's law. You may not have broken the world's law, even though there's a big joke that goes around and say we all commit 3 felonies a day because of all these little financial laws and stuff that are out there. If we've all broken the law, which we have again in the Bible's eyes and God's eyes, then the judge, God, is obligated to render a verdict. He's obligated to say guilty. Or else he's unrighteous. Right? We don't serve a righteous God. But what if the judge allowed someone to stand in for you? What if he said, you know what? Your record's pretty bad. But I know someone has a better record. How about they stand in for you? I'll judge them and I'll credit your guilt to them and I'll give their righteousness to you. What if we could do that? Well, that's exactly what happened, isn't it? In the courtroom of God, in the grand celestial courtroom, that's what Jesus did. The God, our Maker, stood in our place and took the charge, the guilt that we deserved, and gave us His perfect record. That is the peace that Jesus gave us. That is the peace that we have with God, is through that kind of exchange. You know, those anxious feelings that you have when a police officer gets behind you on the road. I experience this a lot here in Vermont. I've been pulled over like 40 times in the 14 months I've been here. And some of it is maybe I look like a terrorist with my beard. I don't know if it's that or if it's the fact that I had North Carolina plates or what it is, but I've been pulled over a lot. I'm a little annoyed by that, if you can't tell. But he's right there behind you. You know, you can tell when they're running your place because they get right up on you. And, you know, I got too much dust on my plate. He's going to pull me over for that or something because I can't read it or whatever. I'm going to get pulled over for something. And, but there's anxiety, right? And you all know that feeling. I think every one of us can relate to that anxious feeling. Well, why is that? Well, it's because there's this sense of, you know, I've probably broken the law somehow. I just don't know how. Probably broken it somehow. Maybe some of us do know how we've broken the law, and we're worried about that. But most of us have that general sense of anxiety. But with God, imagine if that's gone. We don't need to feel like that with God. I think, in a way, we feel like that with God, too, don't we? With God's looking down on me, and I'm just... He's going to strike the hammer of justice is coming down at any moment here. I'm enjoying life too much. And we sort of think that way about God, don't we? That He's right there like this police officer on our bumper ready to pull us over for something. But with Jesus, the kind of peace that we have with Jesus is what I just described. It's imagine that you are absolutely blameless in the eyes of the law. Absolutely perfect. No reason to feel any guilt or shame or fear. In the eyes of the behind you, absolute perfect peace in your heart. That's the peace that God gives us through Jesus, because He has rendered a not guilty verdict for us because of what Jesus did. That's the first reason. The second reason, this is much quicker. Jesus is our Prince of Peace because he teaches us how to live in peace and promote peace in our lives. That's the second reason. So he gave us peace, right? Spiritual peace with God first and foremost, not a governmental kind of police or peace. Because you think of too, Jesus, how many times did y'all, some of y'all were here when we went through Mark, I guess it's been about a year ago now. How many times did they come to Jesus and they thought, you know, this guy's our king. We need to make him king, right? He's our political leader. Let's, Jesus, you're king. Let's make you king. And Jesus would say, no, that's not why I came. He would leave. So even, you know, Jesus not only just didn't happen to be our political peacemaker, he actually ran away from it. So that's not at all what it was about, was it? Jesus didn't come to establish that sort of earthly political kingly peace. It's a spiritual peace. And the second one is, as I just said, promoting peace in our lives, teaching us how actually to live at peace. This is not the world's way. Jesus taught that we find peace with God by surrendering. Saying, I can't do it, Lord. Take my life, take my heart, take my everything. You surrender, you give up. But also peace with our fellow human when we take an attitude of humility, deference, respect, and grace. This is the power of it, right? It's not just that God is this tyrant in disguise and I'm going to win, so give up or else. It's not that, though, that's true of God. God is a king. God is a, every knee will bow one day. That is a true statement. And I don't shy away from that. However, what did he do to demonstrate surrender? He came and he surrendered himself, right? Jesus came and said, this is the way. I will do it first as your leader. I'm going to show you what it's like to live in relationship with men and with God perfectly. He didn't come down and live at the palace down at the end of the road with a big fence around the house. No, he was born in a manger and he gave his life. Listen to this from Philippians. I'm going to close on this. And let this be the application. I don't have to explain what this looks like. This comes right out of the Bible here. It's just, as I was reading, I was like, you know, this is the perfect conclusion. It gives us, what does this look like to live in peace with our fellow man? And why do we call Jesus the Prince of Peace? Well, this is it right here. This comes out of Philippians. I believe it's Philippians chapter chapter 2. I'm going to double check that. It might be Philippians 3. It's chapter 2, yes. I didn't put it in here. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of mind. Listen to this. We're talking about promoting peace in our life. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Hard. And what a politician today would you say actually does that? I think that's the reason we lost so much trust in our leaders. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the other. So you think about what's best for myself, what's best for my brothers, what is best for my neighbor. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus. This is why we call him Prince of Peace. Who being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. That's not powerful. Jesus was God. And he said, you know what? They're killing me, they're crucifying, they're spitting on me, all that sort of stuff. But this is for them, not for me. This is about them. This is about their... Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Peace comes by taking that mentality to heart. Not by asserting your rights and your goodness and your correctness, Where does this start? Where does it start? It doesn't start by saying, you know, I hope that guy across from me over there is listening to this message. He really needs to hear that. It starts there. It starts with you in your home. Right? All of us have this issue at home. Home is, and Martin Luther the Reformer said that home is the crucible of sanctification. That's where it's hardest. It starts at home. Think of the relationships closest to you, spouses, children, brothers, sisters, roommates. Let's start there.